Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I'd like to welcome you to my home. I have a really good friend here today. He's a fun guy. His name's Jay. We're going to be discussing a lot of really interesting topics today that I hope will be fruitful. A lot of these things are big buzzwords nowadays. A lot of things that in my short little life I didn't think would be almost mainstream news now, to have people discussing these things. Like, this is an open forum now on a lot of these topics. But just right off the bat, what would you define as, like, purpose? What is purpose? Like, how do humans define their own purposes?
Like, so I think purpose for the individual gets created over time. I don't believe that anybody is actually born into this world with, like, a predetermined purpose. I think people find their purpose through, again, experiences throughout their life that will, you know, change and shape who they are. For instance, you know, I thought my purpose as a kid was I was going to be a veterinarian. I was, you know, really excited to work with animals.
So you're compassionate.
Oh, definitely. And I would, you know, as a child, constantly check out, you know, animal books from the elementary library and come home with them. And over time that, you know, that changed. And I was like, maybe I don't want to work with animals so much. So my purpose that I thought I had totally shifted. So I think that to define purpose, I can only define my own purpose really in this sense. And that would be to make the most of life and, you know, spread that with others. That's my purpose. I can't really define what purpose is in a sense, though.
So, in the mind of a fungus underground, how would you think it would define its purpose?
Equilibrium.
Yeah.
I would think that, you know, the fungus naturally tries to stabilize and harmonize its natural environment wherever it may be growing. I think that, again, ultimately harmony and equilibrium is what fungus tries to achieve, and we've seen this through, as I've watched many times over and over again, Paul Stamets has explained to us that mushrooms are, you know, only one cell wall thick, and yet they have attained the largest surface area on the planet of any living organism
that's ever been known, right?
It's in Washington, I believe. Washington. It's a honey mushroom. Yeah, it, you know, it's a meadow maker. It's
like 250 square miles or some shit like that.
It is insanely large. Again, it's the largest living organism on the planet, and it all it does is, you know, literally provide for the old growth forest, and getting more into it, I don't know if it's the right time now, but it's
always the right time.
Okay,
you go in any direction whatsoever. I have a couple talking points just to wrangle it if I see any dead space, but yeah. I'm not that afraid.
Okay, so going more into it, like, the honey mushroom itself is a meadow maker. What it does is it takes a surveillance of the nitrogen in the surrounding area, and if the nitrogen count is really low, what it will do is it'll actually climax the trees by at first being a parasite, infecting the trees, causing it to decompose, break down, and
really?
then it turns into what is known as a saprophyte, which is the exact opposite. It starts to feed off of the dead material, and it puts that dead material back into the actual, what's the word I'm looking
for? So is that why they call it a meadow maker? Is because where it is, all the things above it kind of die off, so you have that, like, weird space?
Right, so it'll create a canopy, you know, it'll clear out the canopy of trees and create, you know, grassland where it will then bring in the animals to feed on the grasses, causing them to leave their droppings, which refertilizes the natural environment with more nitrogen.
And then on the outside of the meadows, they're just pushing out that nitrogen and letting the other plants get it.
Right, because with mycelium, it literally has a full conscious understanding of where nutrients are deficient, even if it, again, is a 250-plus mile life form. It can go from, you know, we'll say the furthest point west to point east. It is almost a symbiotic, like, understanding of what nutrients need to go where.
So have you ever heard of Merlin Sheldrake? So he's I keep thinking that he might be related to Rupert Sheldrake, and for a while I claimed that he was. But Rupert Sheldrake's an astrophysicist, so they might be related. But his father was also in the mushroom community, so he grew up with Paul Stamets coming over to his house. He references talking about Stamets.
Really?
He talks about all of the big guys being actively part of his family's while he was a child. So he was indoctrinated to this life study early on. In that book, Entangled Life, which is just fantastic, by Merlin Sheldrake, he quotes the scientific study where they put radioactive sugars into a plant. I think it was some sort of tree, because trees are the big boys in the whole forest, and so trees have bigger connections because they live long lives, so they end up finding more mycelial connections with more colonies, because it's not like there's just one species of mushroom really supporting a forest. There's
right.
millions of species of mushrooms all entangling, all
yes.
fucking with each other, all
yes.
dispensing nutrients with each other,
yes.
while they're also dispensing with big plants. So younger plants, younger trees, plants that don't have long life cycles do not have as many mycelial connections as old trees do. So trees are like governors. Smaller plants depend upon them to be able to have all these resources. So I'm pretty sure it was a tree that had this radioactive sugar put into it. And so since the sugar had this way to it, you could hit it with a black light and it would light up. And it was very significant that this I put this sugar here, which is very scientifically observable. And so using that, they traced the sugar going from the tree down through the roots into the surrounding mycelial connections and acres away in other plants.
Yeah.
And so all these plants are sharing. These are very interconnected systems.
Yeah. So it's literally a community. So as Paul Stamets likes to describe it, again, it is a one cell wall thick living organism that literally divides and conquers and creates guilds and alliances and communities with the other pathogens and things that would essentially destroy it, but it is able to, again, create equilibrium by repathing nutrients to where things need to go. It creates mm-hmm. harmony with the...
And it seems decision-based to me.
100%.
When I hear about it, and this is just a personal feeling, it reeks of economics to me. A lot of people like to use the brain analogy, and I hesitate from looking at these mushrooms as brains the way that we have our brain. There's a lot of people, and what's weird is also in that book, they use electrical signals in these mycelial communities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's electrolysis, there's a X0, which is, again, reeks of processing, but I'm just always so careful about trying to anthropomorphize these human characteristics of our brain onto it. And so when I try to think of these mycelial connections, I think of how these complex systems, how huge groups of creatures interact together. This is how this creature's interacting, is like this, like there's a lot of diplomacy, like you said, it's one cell wall, and each cell I feel like has an autonomy. I at least think so. That's how I feel about it. But it's this colony of autonomous, I don't know what I'm going with. Take it away, sir.
No, I would completely agree. It shows, again, levels of intelligence, and not to use our language to describe,
the intelligence.
Again, to, yeah, put human characteristics onto something that's not human, but we broke off from mycelium, so really we are fungal bodies. It's
I'll go into that more.
Humans broke off of fungal.
Like, what are you talking about? When plants were breaking, so educate me more on that.
Fungus has been around for 3.5 billion years, right?
So before plants.
Correct.
Before animals.
Before a lot of things.
When you have just bacteria, and I'm guessing those are the eukaryotes, and then the archaea. Bacteria, those are the two types of bacteria.
Right.
And you have the fungus, and then you have the That's it, right? And what are those little animals, those single cellular animals? Are those going around yet at this time period?
I'm not too entirely sure on that part. I would honestly have to research that more.
But algae for fuck sure.
What I do know is that mycelium, like the, you know, the DNA essentially for mushrooms, because mushrooms didn't even develop their form until about 1.5 billion years ago, at least that's the earliest that we have in the fossil record. So Okay. Mycelium as a fungus has been around for 3.5 billion years, 2 billion years longer than us knowing mushrooms to actually have their first form. So they are like the intelligent creators and designers of the planet, because they literally took what was already here and decomposed those materials, decomposed those radioactive, you know, the Earth was very uninhabitable 3.5 billion years ago.
You can't have plants without funguses. So the root systems of plants, at least denoted in this book, again, I'm going to quote this book a lot.
No, that's fine.
It's one of my favorite sources.
Yes.
And I loved how you just hopped right on it, I felt like. But the root systems of plants are modeled after mycelial growth, and that's not a coincidence. And there's a lot of plants that don't have roots, and the plants that don't have roots are completely dependent upon fungus and mycelial
nutrient transfers
to get all of their nutrients.
Correct.
They can't survive.
Right.
So there's a running theory that plants developed in concert with fungus first, and that the plants that have complex root systems now, like trees, the only reason they have them is because they based it off of their mycelial partners. So orchids. Orchid seeds are very tiny.
Okay.
Zero sugars. The seed itself is like a speck. It floats on the dust.
Okay.
And the only way that it can germinate is that dust has to interact and find a mycelial partner.
I can see that.
And then once it finds a mycelial partner, that's how the orchid even gets all of its air. That's why it has those huge root structures. If you look at it with a microscope, there's actually tunnels inside those weird roots. And those tunnels allow access for mycelium to get in there.
That's awesome.
And so it's literally bioengineered to be easy access for these creatures to be able to get in there and to give them food.
So that's amazing, because diving into it even more, right? And this full circles with the talking of the honey mushroom, but again, mushrooms are literally the archetypes, the masters of their own environment. They have the ability to survey and, you know, take full note of pretty much everything that is in the area, whether it be, you know, nutrients or whether it be pathogens infecting a certain area. Like, it always has a full and constant communication with everything that it has grown out to, depending on how far it's gone. But where was I going with this? The mycelial mat itself, like going back into the intelligent design where it interacts with plants, if you look at it on a microscopic scale, a one cell level. Well, if you look at that on a microscopic scale, like if you're comparing it to the structure, and I had pictures and notes pulled up for these, but it's the same archetype of your brain network. It's the same archetype of the internet, and it's the same archetype of the universal,
these circuits and these systems.
Correct. So it goes to it goes to show that the mycelium, even though we lack a ability to communicate with it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not
helping us.
Highly intelligent as well. Like, it could be more intelligent to a sense where it doesn't even need communication. Like, there's a point in...
Well, they're so connected. You know, like, the way that these things are, they use chemicals, they use hormones in the soil. You know, these are really complex environments where so many other creatures are giving off these chemical signals, these hormonal signals. They might not be thinking with light, you know. And then consider the difference of our individuality as, like, there's 7 billion of us. We've conquered so-and-so, a lot of people would like to think, this planet. You know, like, but in what way have we conquered it? We have conquered it materially in a certain way, but how has our individuation in comparison to these highly connected, unindividual creatures that have, it's very hard to peg their individuality, you know, like, because where do you peg down the mushroom when it is these, this, like, this highly complex system of entities?
Right. So if we were to use, you know, basic terminology to kind of compare the two, that way it's understandable. Like, if you were to have a, you know, the smartest human on the planet, genius, you know, IQ 200, whatever.
Yeah.
You're, the subconscious and the conscious parts of the brain, because we are humans, don't always link up. And so there is a constant disconnect of being able to really understand
what
our immediate environment, or really where we're going with something. Where if you were to look at mushrooms on a sentient human, you know, if you were to look at them like as you were to look at us, they would essentially be supercomputers. They would be that level of high-tech AI, you know, supercomputing processors that have, again, the ability to
geomap their entire ecosystem. It's like us living in our inside our own matrix.
So we don't understand yet that AI has essentially been on this planet for 3.5 billion years. This is kind of getting more into,
like they are an artificial intelligence.
Archetype design like that has been planted on our planet, and going more into the scientific sense of it. Like, again, our planet has been around for, what, 4.5 billion years? Fungus has been around for 3.5 billion years. There's so many coincidences that allow for life to happen on this planet. And if you look at it under an intelligent design rather than a
an intelligent design, just one that we can't even really conceive of. Yeah, I get it.
We don't have the ability to understand it yet, but we're starting to learn more and more about it. Going into another really clever study about how we've been able to communicate with mushrooms more directly, and again, not in a verbal sense, but in a communication sense, where the experiment was designed by a Japanese scientist, and they were trying to figure out a way to map out their subway system with maximum efficiency. So they used a slime mold on an agar map.
And so slime molds are super basic. So these are not the kind of... These are very primitive fungal communities. They're nothing like the mycelial, the complexity of the mushrooms that like we would eat with oysters or agarica.
Right. Anything that has a fruit body is going to be way very, more very complex. Yes, and it's going to have a way higher level of intelligence in that, you know, traditional sense. But the slime molds... on this agar map, they, you know, pinpointed out all of the different, like, subway stations that would stop at with inoculated oats. So the slime mold... They
give food as a bait.
Yes, the slime mold, the preservation of energy maximizes for maximum efficiency. So the slime mold, within literally 24 hours, was able to completely reformat the subway system that they had with like an upwards of 80% efficiency, based on, again, the conservation of energy, finding the shortest and narrowest point to get to the food places. So yeah, if you're looking at it on a map, and it's harder to picture this, you
it's
know,
like
especially
a kid, it's like a kid doing them, it's like us doing our mazes on the Denny's map. It's like you have a Denny's map, and then it's like they gave the slime mold the Denny's map and said, hey, solve this maze, and the slime mold solved that maze better than the people who designed the subway map,
better by an efficiency of 80%,
which is incredible,
which is insane.
And all the whole while us humans are spending money to fix this shit, keep it up to date, having people base their lives off it.
Yes.
And a very simple creature reformatted it, and I think it was like a day.
Yeah, 24 hours. Like literally day. Within 24 hours. Like, yeah. So we're starting to understand, again, how vastly intelligent even the most simple of fungus is. And if we start to really dive into some of the more complex fungus, then I'm sure we will start to see dramatic changes. And we already are starting to see dramatic changes.
So what's the most complex fungus you could think of?
Ah, man, I honestly would not have...
Something right off the top.
Right, I would not be able to really explain that.
It's just an interesting line, I'm thinking. Like, what would, like, because I know there's those type of, aren't there some of those really stinky ones? It might be a flower. I think I might be mixing up with a flower. Some, like, weird, gigantic, stinky flower.
Well, fungus outnumber every living organism, like, 1,000 to 1 or 100 to 1. Yeah. I have to look up the numbers again, so.
Well, you think about bacteria. There's a shit ton of bacteria, too. What's cool, so, within these mycelial, because they use this almost hydraulic fluid system, don't they? Because that's how they blow up. Like
for the actual fruit body itself.
Yeah, but the fruit body itself is made of the same exact material as a mycelium.
Yeah, it's and still so, just so mycelium so interwoven.
It has this hydraulic mechanism behind it, and within I don't know, don't quote me, but within the actual mycelial communities, there's actually bacteria and viruses that live inside them, mm-hmm. and are performing all these other duties that like there's like this whole theorization of like, well, how much does the nutrients transfer all depend upon the bacteria inside the mycelium? Like, how many of these interlocked systems are we just severely underestimating because we're these big giant land creatures walking around on top of all the shit and we don't even know? And like, yeah, like, so consider this, farmland, how monocultured our farmland is, not just seed but the soil. Mm-hmm. I doubt farmers, especially in industrial places, are making good old-fashioned soil anymore, like mom and pop used to make. You're probably having this huge mass-produced monocultured soil that's probably sterilized in some way to try to make it clean.
Not only that, but it's the soil is now infected with these pesticides and herbicides, and yes,
horrible. That make it hard for natural mycelial communities to come in and help your plants.
And even real plants. That's why everything is GMO now. If you were to take an actual organic seed and planted in soil that has had, you know, even like 2 years of just industrial type agriculture where they're using pesticides and herbicides, you're not gonna have it. Like, it's not gonna make it. It's not gonna last. So the integrity of the mycelium, the how important it is to actually recalibrating the soil.
Rotating to where, and using, you know, like, and they're pretty strong. If we stopped fucking around and we found different ways to protect our plants, I'm not going to say natural pesticides, you know, but just different methods. There's ways to protect your plants without spraying chemicals and these herbicides.
Correct.
Like, I think that we'd be surprised how quickly fungal communities would come back.
So, and this is still the early nature of mycology, because realistically, the study of mycology, like the actual taxonomy, the naming, everything that goes on, the identification, really has all been based on macroscopic features until, you know, we got the microscope.
And shit that's probably poking out of the ground.
Yeah, and so a lot of the mushroom community hasn't even really been discovered yet, or hasn't been detailed in great depth of what all of the benefits, whether it be medicinal, agricultural, you know, therapeutical. There's so many different benefits for so many different mushrooms, like
even food. So I want to pull out, I wrote up these four that I'm really, really into. Cordyceps, lion's mane,
yes, lion's
reishi, mm-hmm. and shiitake.
Yes,
those are some of my four favorite edible mushrooms that I feel are very good nutrient wise.
Yes.
As a cook, because I'm a cook, I was in school for nutrition, and I wanted to be a registered dietitian. I wanted to do institutionalized dietetics, like being in nursing homes, children's homes, and like looking at how to feed them better is what I wanted to do from school. Mm-hmm. So I was really obsessed with that. So I've always been really fascinated by these foods, and lion's mane at least has chemical properties. There's chemicals that they've been able to peg down that seem to be inspire neurogenesis.
Yep.
So these things. Yep. So these things. There's proteins that are very rare proteins that our body doesn't get a hold of often, and that these proteins help the brain to reestablish and to regrow different brain connections.
Yeah, yes.
And it's quick, and you can feel it. Like, when you take a good lion's mane extract, and you've been taking it for a week, after you've taken it, you feel this it's not like quite, it's not a high, it's, but it's this buzz, you yes. know, and you're like, oh, I feel sharp.
Yes.
You know, and like, I've been eating lion's mane for over a year, mm-hmm. you know, and like, I haven't done as much in a reishi. I think shiitakes are just delicious, but there's a lot of cultural significance that people put behind shiitakes.
Yes.
And then cordyceps. I think they're weird. I know that we eat a different species, but you know that the zombie ant?
Mm-hmm.
That's a variant of cordyceps.
Right. Yeah. And then we actually eat those cordyceps as well.
Though, okay. And yeah, then there's also variants of cordyceps that will go after the periodical locusts, and they call them salt shakers of death because they literally make these fungal butt plugs where the cordyceps will infect the back half of the locust, and half of the locust's body is now a fungus. And then it'll be going around screaming the whole time. It's just dropping spores everywhere they go. And then just hundreds of these infected things. So inside the infected cordyceps, guess what chemicals they found flooded in the locust brain?
Which one?
Psilocybin.
That's awesome.
Yep. Not in the zombie ant. The zombie ant was some other chemical. And then there's another species of locust. And I'm pulling this all from a BBC podcast I heard. It was BBC Crowd Science, I think. But there's another one where the locust, it was the same species, it was a different kind of cordyceps, the same butt plug. But this one was using amphetamine. And so they had them high on an amphetamine. So it's weird because it's not just psilocybin that they're producing, and they're using it outside of the human species, which shows that psilocybin is also affecting other creatures, which is one of the things that I've always theorized, is that we're all running on something similar when it comes to the serotonin.
Well, psilocybin, much like cannabis, has their own receptor systems within your brain. They're literal receptor systems for psilocybin, for psilocin, the...
And it's not just based on the serotonin systems, because I always assumed that it was because it was so similar to serotonin that it was almost imitating serotonin.
I would honestly have to look into that a lot more. I was rewatching how it actually links into the receptors today. But again, I was busy with a lot of work. I had a lot of stuff to do.
Oh, absolutely no pressure, brother. Yeah.
But yes, the cordyceps, there's so many, and they're actually very. So many different types of variants of the cordyceps species. Like Paul Stamets himself has used cordyceps to take care of fungal gnats, to take care of termites, all sorts of different types of pests. It's a natural pesticide, which is beautiful because, again, this is what farmers should be using. You know, going back to their agricultural farming, we need to be studying these things more. To be able to use them with the proper plants, with the proper, you know, pests that are in such areas, so that we can target things and not affect the land. It would actually benefit the soil because, again, most fungal properties...
It's not just going and being a zombie. It's not just zombifying ants. It's doing something similar to the honey one in the meadow. It might zombify some ants, but whatever the mushroom does, it's probably giving back a lot more to its community than just the zombie.
Well, that's exactly what it's doing. Like, is it's breaking down and it's killing all of those pests. And instead of those pests destroying those plants, the mycelium is then breaking down the nutrients that would have come from those pests, redistributing into the plants. Right. So it's a very beautiful thing. And that doesn't, you know... detriment the soil for years to come, to where, you know, within the next 10 years that soil won't even be able to be used by the next farming generation because it's so drawn down with all of these chemicals.
And the water. I just imagine the water and the communities and all the shit that we're drinking.
Yeah.
The fact that we have to treat it the way we do.
It's insane. Like, and so going more into that, we have discovered different species that help with these chemical cleanups, and this is where, you know, mycology just becomes such a fascinating subject because you really do start to realize that there's literally a mushroom for everything. Like, there's, you know, there's a fungal property to take care of all of our, you know, standard issues that we have, whether it be pests, whether it be chemical waste, like, in this thing.
You heard about the ones eating radiation?
Yes. Yep. The Chernobyl mushroom that Paul Stamets actually discovered. He discovered the radiation mushroom outside of Chernobyl that literally breaks it down to within its elemental compounds. That's...
And there's ones that eat plastic in like a couple weeks that are like breaking down plastic and turning it into oil-based products that we can then reuse.
And then going further into that, so yes, you take those fungus and you combine them with what I have pulled up here is the oyster mushrooms that actually deteriorate deteriorate oil so we can get off of fossil fuels.
And oysters are really fucking common too, which is super easy. They're one of the easiest mushrooms. Anybody can grow them.
Correct.
You get them in a box and put them on your windowsill and spray them with a bottle and they're going. Like, they're super easy.
And they're good for you too. Like,
and then they also have these amazing properties where they can be trained to do this kind of shit. It's just insane.
So it's honestly amazing. Like when we start to get into all of the different things that we can actually do with fungus, we start to realize that a lot of the world's issues that we see today, whether it be, I personally think of Fukushima being one of the worst, since we're on that topic of radiation eating mushrooms. You know, one of the best things that we could possibly do for that would be to inoculate, you know, just billions of burlap sacks and throw them into the Fukushima ocean, and over time it would eat up all of the radiation. Like, it's not a quick and easy fix, but it's,
you might need some other inoculations over time. You just keep throwing
For sure. Like, it's definitely a project that would need to be maintained, but actually compared to what they're doing right now for treatment and everything else,
it's nothing.
It's the overall cost and efficiency of, you know, the growing of mushrooms versus, again, they have to go out there in waves of people with chemical treatments, all of their high-tech machines to be able to try and filter all of, like, it's a complete waste of money overall when you look at the actual amount of money that you would put into just growing a massive mushroom operation. Like, it would be pennies on the dollar, and it would clean up the ocean a lot more efficiently and a lot faster than what we're doing right now.
So mushrooms grow incredibly quickly, a lot quicker than most people even recognize.
Yep.
Like, a fruiting body of a mushroom will appear usually within like 12 hours.
It can double every 24 hours.
Yeah.
It can double in size every 24 hours, so you can literally observe,
It happens before your eyes almost.
Yeah.
Like, and nothing else grows that fast. And like, for like our bodies, the amount of time it takes us to put mass on, like, it's not even a comparison. Other than the food you put in your stomach, but that's not like your body's actually growing. Like, this thing puts on mass, like,
which is why, like, the term mycophobia was coined, because people don't understand that something that grows that fast,
it just appears overnight. It has some magic.
It can, you know, it could heal you, it could kill you, it could, you know, completely change your local environment if you used it properly.
So use the word mycophobia.
Yeah.
Whereas the inverse of that would be mycophilia.
Yeah, correct. The love of mushrooms, which, once people start to really dive into the subject, a lot of people actually really do fall in love with just the overall mystery of what, you know, mycology has to offer and all of the different aspects of life it really takes a part of. It's a beautiful thing. It, you know, again, it's the only living thing on the organism other than ourselves that has the ability to impact the environment such as we do. Like, no other organism, I would say, I don't know, other than bees, but even then, the planet's still going to be around if, you know, all the bees die off. It might take...
If all the fungus disappeared, we'd be fucked.
We'd be destroyed. There'd be no planet. There'd be nothing.
And they think there was a time period before fungus were able to decompose where there was, even though it was all single-celled life, where there was quite a bit of muck. You know, before decomposition was actually a thing.
Yes.
I think there was actually a sizable time period where there was not a lot of decomposition, like, the way we know it.
Yes.
And, like there was just, like, a very mucky world. Like...
So, yes, I like to get into a little bit more of, like, conspiracy research when it comes to that, especially when it coincides with things such as mycology. Well,
so it's not lizard people, right?
No, definitely not lizard people, but I want, like, going back into intelligent design, the intelligent design of mushrooms in mycology, if you're looking at the planet and the overall evolution phase and how quickly it has happened, again, none of this would have happened without fungus. Like, none of this would have been possible without fungus, so we have to start to ask ourselves, well, where exactly did fungus come from when the planet is, you know, cold and dead and only has single cell life forms on it?
Do you think there was one archetypical single cell? Do you think there was one single celled organism organism that started to, over time, maybe split into these branches? Because if we're going back, if there's a reductionist approach to this, which I feel always heavily when it comes to dichotomous,
yes,
like hierarchies. And it appeals to me. It makes sense. But within that, I think there's two assumptions that come out, because in the end goal, that means that diversification would always be ongoing, like a wine glass, which means that as history goes on, it's even more and more diversity, which, yes, but within those little pockets, like, I don't know. So the further back you reduce back towards in the prehistory, you know, like, could there have been one single cell archetype, like archetypical, just one organism that like split over time?
If we're going like, yeah, I think specifically for Earth's history, I don't think that that happened, just because, again, it's too short of a time frame.
Some people say we receded.
Right, and that's actually the term that I was going to use, was that Earth, if you want to look at it from a technological standpoint, you know, we're talking about terraforming Mars right now, by nuking, you know, the poles in order to create the water flow to bring back the life forms.
Interesting. I haven't heard that. Is this a Musk idea?
It was, yes. Yes.
This is good.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But it does actually make a lot of sense.
That's an interesting idea.
So you and that's very primitive, though. Like, that's, you know, that's...
But it would get put a shit ton of water vapor. Who's to say how quickly it would disperse? Or maybe you'd want to have a little bit more air before you nuke the poles.
I think that... Oh, man. I think that just nuking the poles in general is not a good idea. I mean, I think that we should stay away from big explosions as much as possible.
Another alien planet.
Yeah. Mars is already in, you know.
What if they started fighting mammoths in the chunks?
that would be great. I think that we would find life on Mars, honestly. But
even if it was just a short little run and then died off, who's to say? You know, like,
I think that in going just more into this, I think that we came from the fifth planet that's no longer there, that's an asteroid belt, and that Mars was actually our second seeded planet, like our original home as the human race.
What did they call it? The one that hit Earth and made the moon, they called it Thera, something with a T.
I honestly don't know.
That's their moon theory. That would fit yours, because they did say that's what, there was some monumental collision that made the moon happen, and who's to say maybe there was some sort of body there, you know? But like, yeah, that's interesting.
I could see that, but I could also see a long time. I actually don't even know how young our solar system is, like our actual galaxy. But
who fucking knows?
If you're looking at it, so if you're looking at it on a cosmic scale, right? 4.5 billion years. It seems like a long time. Technology wise. How long has the computers been around, right? How long have we actually had the technology that we have now? So if you have a planet that is 4.5 billion years old and you have another planet that is 4.6 billion years old, on a cosmic scale, they're our twin brother, right? But on a technological scale, they could be 100 million years into the future. They That's could true. Have a very well-established society, so technologically advanced that we would never even begin to understand.
And presumably we're only halfway through our life cycle on this planet. Presumably. So if something does get a harness for that long, what if they got a harness earlier?
Yeah.
What if they get their harness at 3.2 billion years? You know, and then at the end, then that thing is a billion years ahead of us. So, all right, I know we're getting way off topic, but
it does.
I will drag us back. I have this really, have you ever heard of the great filter idea?
I have not.
So the great filter idea is this theory on why we haven't contacted life yet, because I'm obsessed. I do think that the logic says that with all the planets and all the things out there, there has to be life out there.
Mm.
I'm not convinced on a lot of the things that I see, you know, like on TV. If something happens to me, I would be giddy, you know, but I do not doubt life. So one of the metaphysical theories that comes out is called the great filter, which is basically that all life forms, when they reach a certain level of intelligence, they somehow kill themselves off. So there's a filter.
Okay.
You know, like we nuke ourselves to death, we destroy our own planet.
Okay.
You know, another theory that I've heard is just mass distance, is that the distances between bodies is just so immense that the physiology of it means that we can't reach to the next body. It's too hard to hop islands. And that even when a species reaches a technology, there's physical barriers to get them across the distances. You know,
talking about like a traveling distance?
A traveling species.
Okay.
So, yeah. And so level three of this theory, which I really love, it's called the Great Server.
Mm-hmm.
So basically that we are here on this level of existence, but that other species transcend either spiritually,
mm-hmm.
they transcend physically to a higher level of being, mm-hmm. or as the great server, which is the basic of it, which is they transcend onto a server of forms, and that interstellar society has a interstellar matrix that they put their consciousness onto because of the mass distances. Sorry, my plurals are fucked today. So the reason we haven't contacted anybody is because we're still muddling around on this space because we haven't gotten onto the server or we haven't gotten onto the next level yet.
So I want to go to the self-destructive one because I think that, again, this does actually go... Like, I think that this all does actually coincide, especially with mycology, because we are talking about... Again, intelligent design here. So I think that all of this actually does really fit hand in hand together. Because again, if you do, it doesn't even have to be outside of our own solar system. Again, just
we're talking in our system.
We're talking about this planet, our solar system, our nine planets, like, you know, Earth, Mars, whatever the fifth planet would have been that's now an asteroid belt. You could even include Mercury, you know, in... Is Mercury first or Venus?
Mercury's first.
Okay, Venus. So it'd be Venus, because Mercury is too close to the sun to be terraformed, but Venus definitely has the ability. It would just be insanely hot, so we would have to have, like, pod-like structures there.
Well, you'd have to greenhouse gas it. So we'd have to have solved the problem that we have now.
Yeah, but this all has to do with mycology and understanding fungus, though, because this is how we, you know, terraform planets and actually really create an environment and create the atmosphere for life to be able to thrive and continue on. So, say that, you know, the fifth planet actually did exist, and we don't... I don't know how long the asteroid belt is. I guess I would have to do more research on this.
Well, it's huge because it.
But how long has it been around, right? Like, how long has our actual solar system been? I know that Earth is 4.5 billion years old. I don't know how old our sun is.
I'm very skeptical. I think that it's been around for a long, long time. But I think our numbers, like, what are... I think they're definitely guesstimations. I don't, like, especially for that far back. I feel like it's a heavy guesstimation.
I think that it is, but on a mathematical and technological based scale. And again, this is just basing it off of what we have today.
Fungus theory, yeah.
It would be a plausible theory, mm-hmm. and I think that this goes into, again, the destruction, the self-destruction. Because if we were at that point of intelligence on that fifth planet,
Are you talking about a prehistoric species, a prehistoric civilization, before this one on a separate planet?
Right.
Well, and there's all kinds of, like, myths about it. Like,
because we have, so if I could just wrap, throw in something that wraps in mycology with it, because I don't want us to get too far off the subject, but we have found essentially what would be seeded pods, seeded balls. I don't know if you've heard about this, but, like, you know, millions of them, seeded balls that have intelligent design based around them, based on how they were, that would have had the ability to literally let out, like, millions of spores. And
So these are fungal bodies.
They are metallic spheres that have
metal.
Yes, they are metallic spheres that have been intelligently designed
with the spore dispersion.
Yes, system. With the capability of seeding, like, the planet, with that specific intelligent design of seeding spores throughout wherever these balls were.
Then the fungus get to work. You wait a little bit of time.
So I think that Earth was, again, a science project for that fifth planet. They seeded this planet with those fungal bodies, which allowed the atmosphere to develop over time, and then eventually colonized the planet, you know, billions of years later. We are kind of going off.
That's a very interesting theory. I think it's very unique. I've heard breeds of the seeding theory. I've heard different breeds of the seeding theory, but I have not heard that angle yet. And I think that's very interesting. I'm incredibly open-minded. A little backstory. I'm a very skeptical human being.
Yes.
I would consider myself a philosopher of sorts. But
okay.
I consider myself an idealistic agnostic, an ideal agnostic. idealistic, whatever. So basically, you know, when I heard agnosticism when I was originally a child, mm-hmm. it was always like this God agnosticism. Oh, God could or couldn't exist.
That's right.
Always how I, so I'm taking that, and I'm taking the word agnostic to the extreme. I feel so skeptical about our fundamental reason as humans, you know, and I have a lot of, I think we're beautiful creatures, mm-hmm. and I love having my body, and my brain makes a lot of really cool shit happen. But I feel like perception as a whole is kind of like a car, you know, like it's like a really nice car. You can really enjoy driving the car, but I always feel like I'm like behind the wheel of the car. And so there's this film between me, and I find my reason just as far past that. It's on the other side. It's like the reason doesn't feel like it's mine wholly, and it's like it's part of the mechanism, and you can use it like a sports car, and if you drive the car really well, you can win races, and it can be a very enjoyable experience, and you need it. And like another analogy I like is like a ship in a sea, you know, like I feel like reason and our perception and the way that we use our reason is like if you're in the middle of an ocean, you cannot jump off the boat, you will die. Your physical, like you're the soul, whatever, that essence, that spark, this is my woohoo, you know, like whatever you, that observer that's observing things, you know, that's on the other side of the wheel, if you jump off your boat, you're fucked. And so you're very dependent upon your body. So it's like I hate people who are like, oh, you gotta kill the ego, you gotta kill all this shit, you know, like, because you really need all that parts and those pieces. So when it comes to a lot of these theories and all these things, I'm always very open-minded to it. I recently joined a bunch of flat earth groups. You know, yeah. I spent a lot of time speaking to flat earthers,
yeah.
and not to in any way compare your theory to flat earth. Yeah. I think there's leagues between, you know,
yeah.
like the fundamental, even using reason, it seems very unlikely.
Yeah.
But like, I think nobody can know well enough. And that's why I brought up the guesstimation with these numbers. You know,
yes.
at the back of my head, I'm always going to doubt when somebody tells me a direct number.
Yes,
but it seems very likely.
And I don't want to use direct numbers. I just use it as like a frame. Yeah, correct. As a frame of reference for people to understand. I guess what my subjective thought on the bigger experience or the bigger picture or mm-hmm. what the reason for life is.
And I like it. It's a good, I thought it was a very interesting theory.
And for me, it's like, if I could, my standpoint on like, I don't necessarily have a higher belief. I don't think there's a God. I think that like people who claim they're atheists, or people who claim in, what is it? Simulation theory.
Okay, like, that one's weird.
Yeah, simulation theory. I think simulation theory is a cop out for atheists because they don't want to believe in God. But it's essentially the same outcome, right?
Like, so, have you ever heard of Descartes?
I have not.
So, Rene Descartes, he's the guy who made Cartesian graphs. So, any graph that is a box graph, mm-hmm. those are called Cartesian graphs. He's the first person to use that system to use charting. He was a philosopher back in the 1700s. He locked himself in a tower, and he exposed himself to painful doubt. Basically, he put himself under this rigor by himself, basically as a hermit. And he was a very religious man, but he decided that there could be a malicious demon feeding him false information at all time periods.
Okay.
And so any thought that he could have could be something that's being fed to him by this evil demon to make him see the world as he sees it, which for me was just simulation theory before you had computers. So like I think there's always been people taking it to that extreme, you know, like
I think like mathematically simulation theory makes sense.
Well, there's actually a mathematic proof now.
Yeah.
So, and this is where I get even doubtful. Like,
yeah.
There's a mathematic proof where this guy, he mathematically analyzed it, and looking into this code, I forgot how he did it, but he found, like, doing some measurement, he found this code that appeared so often that the only way that that pattern could happen is if it was designed.
Mathematically designed, intelligently designed.
Using programs, the way that a computer's programmed.
And we're starting to see these repeating intelligent designs, like...
And you're saying that about mushrooms as well earlier.
Correct.
You said that these systems also, is like in the universe and the brain, like the
internet,
computer, and
yes,
all these sort of internet systems.
It all has the same over structural archetype. Like it's intelligent design. It's showing that there may be a higher power, but I think that, again, the most logical thing for me, if anything, would be simulation theory. Like, I think that for me, it's the purpose of life is to experience life to the fullest, to be able to learn, you know, as much as you possibly can, for whatever reason. So that if...
Oh, this is the first question. The purpose.
So if you transition into... So that if there is an afterlife, you know, I personally don't care if there is or if there isn't. Like, I am on this... I'm in this existence to live my life to the fullest, to be the best person that I can be, to bring, you know, joy, quality, open-mindedness, different experiences to people who wouldn't.
What does otherwise... the word service mean to you? Does it mean anything? Does it hold any weight?
Service sounds like, to me, would be like a not good word. It sounds so to it, me, it service
holds,
is like
it holds a lot of positive connotation for me.
I can see that it would.
This right here, this show costs me money,
right?
And I never want to make money from it because this is a little attribute of service.
Yes, you know,
like we were talking about earlier about Good Samaritans.
Yes,
you know, like so for me, I feel like I want to figure out some way to be able to serve our species in a beneficial way, and through that, our planet. Because I'm convinced that by being positive models and by living happily, like you were saying, living to our fullest, and being in a state of learning and being in a state of curiosity, simply being seen as a model of that has a positive benefit, and then other people pick that up as well. And
I agree
that it's contagious. You know, like so, and I see that as service.
Yeah.
That's how I see the word.
So that I would, my translation would be like voluntarism. I am
voluntary.
Like I am voluntarily putting my effort out into the world without expecting anything back in return. Like I am doing this because
unconditional love.
Yeah, I genuinely want life to be better. Like. Because right now, if we're being real, life sucks. Like, if you're looking at it, you know, you got to work a 9-to-5. You got to make money to live. Yes, as you were just saying, you have to pay for this business. And, you know, I don't...
To get voices heard.
Yeah.
To hopefully push people to be curious.
Right. So it's just very unfortunate that we have to live by that, you know, by that dynamic, by that model. And
One day I'm going to quit everything. And
yeah.
Like, as soon as my son gets to a certain point where he's self-sufficient, I don't plan to work for the rest of my life. There's this one... you watch Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia?
I have not.
Oh, man. That's something you got
to
write
down. Yeah, I'm going to have to take a lot of notes from this.
Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia is a really good TV show based off Vice. But there's this mushroom vagrant where this dude just lives off in the hills and he eats nothing but wild mushrooms that he forages. Like, and, like I'm going to be that guy and then I'll come down from the mountains once every moon and come down with a soapbox and just yell at
people. On the soapbox, yes. See, I don't mind work and I don't mind the word service, but it has to be something that I'm doing and that I love. And I think that mycology would be that overall outlet for me. Yeah. I could see myself taking the business of mycology in that traditional sense of capitalism.
Stamets has started it. You've seen how, I think with Stamets, that was a crucial movement in the past 10 years to showing how somebody can take this and commercialize it.
Oh, 100%.
And so it's very easy, you know, like...
I want to take it to the next level of...
And have an effect.
And you're right. And actually have an effect going back into that voluntarism, that voluntary mindset of really using this business. Again, I don't want to... Once it gets to the point where it is fully self-sufficient as mycology is in its own right, a well-put-together business will be over time as well. You literally will be able to start putting these things back out into nature. And I would love to... with a successful business model, again, voluntarily recreate my environment, right? Like, I want to be able to provide for my natural, you know, provide for my immediate community. I want to be able to provide for my external community.
And live comfortably while doing it.
Probably. Correct. Live comfortably. I don't have any... one of the main things with consumerism is it plants this idea into people's heads that to be successful, you know, you need to be wealthy and have all of these big grand things, make a name for yourself. And I don't think that any of that actually in the end has any true value, which is why a lot of wealthy people are often
not very happy.
Yeah, depressed. because they realize that they might be creating their own value, but they're not actually creating any external value for their community. And that external suffering is always...
You just hit the nail right on the fucking head. That needs bright highlighter all over it. That's the key. People making their own value but not considering the value that they can make for their community. And that's the message of the mushroom. I think that, yes. That's the key word right there. That's how the mushrooms do. You know, like, they might make a meadow, but you underestimate what they do for the community. Small sacrifices.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the key.
Yeah.
Right.
It really is, though. I mean, in these wealthy... independent business people have the ability to impact their community immediately overnight if they were to
if you just threw a couple hundred million billion dollars at something, you know, just try, just see what happens if you threw it at just some random country in Africa.
Or if you did it again, I would like to personally do it locally, you know. My overall goal would be something like the 5-Hour Energy CEO, where you literally have your own scientific, you know, establishment, where he took a lot of his profits and built like his own facility where they work on research development, and he has created, you know, like water filtration, free energy, where, you know, you're cycling this wheel inside your house and it will generate power for, you know, 2 days. Like, it's very minor steps, but with the amount of money that he's putting into it, like, it's making, you know, good headway, and all it requires is just more financial backing, and you can build these systems in mass scale and more efficiently. And
keeping those systems going.
Correct. Like,
making a system that you can give to somebody, like the teach a man to fish versus giving him a fish. You know?
Right.
You make new systems for people to think smarter, think differently.
We can run like power efficiency systems at like over 3,000% right now. We're wasting so much kinetic energy, whether it be cars traveling on the road, people walking, like the overall movement of wind in Colorado. We have insane wind here, and you know, there's so much energy that's being wasted that literally can be retransitioned back into the immediate environment, where you know, a city such as Colorado Springs can be fully self-sufficient, run on its own power, not be connected to any type of grid, grow its own food, be completely independent, and that can happen within a year for, I think it was $300 million, which is really a not large amount of money at all. And that's
for investment.
It's for that's very basic
it's
systems.
It's a very good investment. It's better than investing in a pipeline just to drag out more oil.
Right. So it's...
So what are the spiritual attributes of magic mushrooms? And this is not an advocation for anybody out there to go procure something that might be illegal. This is purely a theoretical, hypothetical conversation on the subjective effects of these things. Like, what do you think the spiritual attributes are, like, even culturally, you know, like, going back into all these other cultures that have been using it for thousands of years, you know, like, there's a lot of new movements for these things, hopefully, to be decriminalized soon, you know?
Yeah, there's actually...
I'm always just very careful, you know, very careful when it comes to these sort of things.
Definitely.
But
even more so, let's talk about like the immediate medicinal benefits. Much like lion's mane, the neurogenesis benefits that come from psilocybin mushrooms.
People don't think about it. It doesn't just fuck you up.
Are insane. Like,
it's not just to fuck you up at all.
A microdose, 0.1, you know, 0.1 of a dose has the neurogenesis benefits that last for months. Like, you know, 6+ months, we've seen that people have holistic connective benefits, where they feel more in tune with the things that are around them. Some of I actually have notes on this.
Awesome.
So
I've been really excited to hear your opinion.
4 medicinal benefits of psilocybin mushrooms. According to reveal severe depression and anxiety. This is very important, especially with PTSD. A lot of people have trauma. A lot of people have depression. A lot of people have things that bother them in their past, and it comes up in what is known as like triggers, and
like trauma, which a trigger is related to a trauma. That's something that's happened in the past. It's been painful, and then that reoccurs a new response in the present.
Right. So for let's take a very basic example. Let's say someone had, you know, an abusive father, and every time that they were done abusing their child, they slammed the door after they were done. Mm-hmm. Now, for the rest of their life, that person has a trigger where any time that a door gets slammed more than just above average, they're reacting to it in like a negative way.
Or even a car alarm going on outside.
It really,
like some really strange abstract thing that you're just like, why does this make me feel uncomfortable?
Right, and other people won't understand that. They don't understand that those type of, you know, reactions happen within those people because of things that have happened in the past. And even though they don't happen with them that way, it could severely affect those individuals. So
it's an old hard run path, like an old hard path in the forest. It's in our brain.
Yes.
It's and then what I would suppose happens when the psilocybin comes and interacts is it allows you to walk a new path.
Yep.
Even once. And you might be able to walk the old path and have a reoccurring feeling, but at least you now have two paths to choose from.
Well, right? You have a more holistic understanding of what happened with that path. Yeah. So it rebranches those neurological pathways to be able to understand it in a more complete sense, where when you're coming at it from the base trauma, like, it comes across very direct, and it comes across as very much cause and effect, rather than this is why this happened to me in the past, and this is, I don't need to fear this anymore. That's what that new building of the new neurons is. It allows you to build that new pathway, like you said, of instead of going down this path every single time you hit that trigger, you've rebuilt a new pathway where now your brain has that ability to take.
And it's a bizarre experience when it's happening in person, and you can almost feel it happen, I would say, because in my practice, I will set intentions for quite a while before I'll embark on any sort of journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll spend up to a week, setting intentions where I'll carry a lot of nerves for a while, where it's a nerve-wracking experience, because I am not trying to fuck around. You know, like, usually I'm trying to do intense work. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to work on shit when I'm using tools like this.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is a medicinal tool. It is a cognitive tool. It is, I do not think it should be used.
It's not a toy.
Recreationally. Yeah, I do not think it should be used.
I think it could be used socially, and I think it can be used socially in a beautiful way if you're surrounded with people who love you.
100%.
But it's a totally different thing, and when I'm with other people, I can't do as much work on myself. I'm a mama bird. So when I'm with other people, I'm taking care of other people all the time, and I don't even focus on my own shit. So when I'm working on my own shit, I'm in a dark room with some music, and I'm like, all right, buddy, we're sitting here. We're going to think for a little bit, you know? And so I felt those fears happen because I recently had a surgery on my leg, you know, and like, I had a bunch of veins pulled out of my leg, you know? Oh, blah, blah, blah. All these holes is where they went in here, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So like, and months beforehand, you know, those were intentions I was setting, and I made doctor's appointments in my head, where I'd sit from the doctor and have these artificial conversations in my head, working on these things over and over again, and feeling the knots of tension unwind.
Yeah.
You know, and waking up the next morning, and you know, it was still a fearful experience, and I still had a hard time when I got there. But because of all the practice I put in beforehand, working through it, you know, like, you can feel that fear unwind. And they've witnessed this shit in mice too.
Yes.
Like, there's so many of the things where they've done it with mice where they've like conditioned these mice to be terrified. And then like one dose of psilocybin, the mice don't give a shit.
Yeah, it helps with the fear response.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. So that's point number one. Do you have another point?
Well, there's, you know, quite a few things that go into this. The fear response is definitely a big one. You know, again, people being a shaman back in the day, like the person who would ingest these psychoactive, you know, ingredients, whether it be mushrooms or anything else, were considered to be highly revered. Like, you know, it was an honor to be able to take these sacraments back mm-hmm. in the day. Like, you to be able to be a shaman, be able to talk about these things was...
You almost had to have somebody you knew beforehand to give you that power, too. Like with Don Juan, I don't know if you know the story of Don Juan. Oh, that's another good one. That's for another day. But, you know, like, I feel like a lot of these shamans had teachers. You know, they found somebody who taught them how. Who was priorly a shaman.
So I'm sure it's a thing that has been passed down for thousands of years throughout every single culture that we know. There's been some sort of consumption of mind-altering substances. Because it is a natural state that humans, you know, crave.
Like, even animals.
Animals especially. Whether it be, you know, caffeine, sugar, like there's so many different drugs, chemicals, nicotine, like out there, that alcohol, that create, you know, altered states of perception. People are constantly seeking altered mind states.
Well, even your phone. They've been able to measure incredible dopamine responses just from scrolling on Facebook, you know, and you get a hit every time you find something, you know.
Like, yep, I can see that too. So it, you know, being a shaman, being a courageous leader, the ability to get over these fears, you know, you're living in a jungle, you're surrounded by natural predators, you're surrounded by enemies, like, you have to be courageous, you have to be able to get over these things that would steer you off from staying alive or keeping your village alive, keeping your people alive. So it helped out greatly with the fear response.
I can see that heavily, you know, at least having one man who's like, hey, or woman, who's like, hey, like, you know, like, I'm very settled, you know, we need to sit back here and meditate and talk about this shit. You know, maybe you need to eat a little bit, maybe you need to chill out. Like, that guy's real settled because he's been going through these fear responses on his own for a while. Like,
coming back to modern day, it definitely helps with addiction, any type of heavy addictions. It has been shown to, again, repath those neurological ways, where when the brain gets into those habitual patterns of wanting to go to the same exact thing over and over mm-hmm. again.
Hit that lever.
Yeah, whether it be hard drugs, again, whether it be coffee, sugar, like, it doesn't always have to be something, like, terribly detrimental, but people do have addictions to multiple different things. It, instead of taking that same neurological pathway that has been set pretty much in stone, it allows you to branch off and build new neurological pathways. And when you get to that fork in the road, it's a lot easier to choose
a different choice.
A lot easier to choose a different choice. And this goes back into my next thing that I have here, is rebooting the brain. So it disables the neural network in charge of fears and obsessions, leaving, you know, different parts of the brain free to communicate. This goes into PTSD, which is very essential, especially for, you know, our military. Like, our military suicide rates have been insanely high, and I think this is one of the main reasons why Denver was one of the first cities in America, was the first city in America to decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms, because we do in Colorado have, you know, so a lot of the highest military bases. We have insane suicide rates with military people. It's mm-hmm. it is an ongoing.
So you're thinking it has something to do with a lot of these depression clinics who are looking for new medical trials?
Yes,
there's so much studies happening right now.
So many studies.
There's so much actual real science where we have government funded studies happening right now.
Yes,
hundreds and hundreds of shit. It's really the fucking renaissance of this country.
It's a beautiful thing to see. It really is. It's a beautiful thing to see that people are lifting, you know, the superstition veil of psychedelic mushrooms and it being this, you know, woo-woo drug that puts you into this altered state of mind that makes you do crazy things. No, there's so much more to that. And even to get to that state of mind, you have to be taking quite a considerable amount. Like, we're talking very microscopic amounts for people to have life-changing experiences. Like, you don't have to ever get to that crazy point where...
But even then, I would like to have the disclaimer that even at higher doses... Like, I feel that people should always have a a good environment, like have people, don't take it like in a home alone, I would say. I don't know.
I guess it depends on like your, this depends on your intention as well, like your intention when taking the substance.
Because but like this one versus other psychedelics, like I would say lysergic, I think there, it's a lot more leniency when it comes to the cap and stem. Like when you mess up with things like lysergic, you can be stuck for a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, like I've never had, I personally have never had an awkward experience last for longer than even like 20 or 30 minutes. I've had some awkward moments where I'm like, ooh. You know, so, like, but I can.
Have you ever had like any, like specifically on, you know, psilocybin, like any external, like out of body and very intense experience?
I'm a very grounded individual. Okay. And I'm very dense and I'm very boring. Mm-hmm. And I love words, but I'm not creative. I have heard many stories from things like Deem, you know, mm-hmm. even. I rarely go, I'm so boring. It's the only thing I can think of. And so, like, the biggest hallucination that I get from a cap and stem is a very strong voice. And a lot of the times I'm so hard bent on what I'm thinking about, and I'll get strong visuals. Like I can build stuff in my head.
Okay.
Like, but I'll build rooms. Like I said, though, like I built a hospital visit and I ran myself through this thing, you know? And so like I can build things, but I've never seen, it's very rare for things to just hop out. You know, and so when I'm having an awkward moment, it's usually based around guilt. It's usually based around something that's happened in reality. Yes. And it's usually something I need to work on for, in the first point anyway. So it's usually a beneficial thing anyways.
Right.
But I've known people that are very more creative than me, like artistic people. I've heard beautiful things. Have you ever tried salvia? This is something I'll talk about openly because it's illegal.
I have, but it was only in high school, and I did it once, and it put me in a hallway. Like, I was sitting on my couch, scary. And it went to a hallway.
It's scary. Salvia is one of the scariest things that's I've crazy. Ever seen in my life, and it blows me away that that's the one that you can go order online right now. So my friend gave me like a bag of it, and so I smoked it quite a bit, and I think I smoked it probably 6 or 7 times over a period of 2 weeks, and it was 60 by, which is the 60 by extract,
okay,
which is the one that you take like a half a puff of and then you're just fucked.
Okay.
Like, and so like the first time we did it, we had a bong and we're all sitting in this circle, and it's like it's just going around in a circle, and the first time I was too nervous, I didn't hit it. Second time comes around, I hit it too much, and so like I remember just sitting on this chair, and then like it's such a weird hallucinogen because it's the first one that like really takes away all of my conscious control.
Yeah.
You know, like, and when I did that one, I remember I'm just sitting on this chair, and I remember everything past the borderline of this fucking recliner was just like literally like crystals of shapes, and like everything was fucking gone.
Wow.
And I remember I'm just sitting there, and I'm just like, I remember just feeling like I'm on a podium, like I couldn't even move my legs, and I'm just like, I can't get off this chair. And I remember I just sitting there, and I was just like, I'm okay, I'm gonna breathe through this. It's like, I can get through this, I know I'm gonna be okay, I'm okay. And so that was the first time I'd experienced salvia like ever. But the person next to me who had done it, like the whole time I'm in this, I'm like, I'm on a chair and I can't see past the chair. If I get up, I'm going to fall and hurt myself. That's my mindset.
Wow.
You know? Wow. And then the girl next door, the one who hit it right before me, she comes and she's like, she has built an entire fucking city that she has observed. She's told me in her head, she's like, I closed my eyes.
This was a salvia.
Yeah, and she's like, I closed my eyes and I saw all these little people building a city on a hill. And she's like, I watched them build a city. Okay. Like, she has this whole fucking narrative.
Okay.
You know? And like, I mean, I've heard so many different stories from Deems, you know, like people see amazing things, mm-hmm. and I don't. I'm just so boring. And it's because I lack imagination. I think it's a very individual thing. I think these tools expand the person. And so if you have a very creative person who has an imagination who can produce those things, I think you're going to see amazing things happen. Like,
I would agree very extensively. But speaking anecdotally, like, I love mushrooms. I think that they're one of the most beneficial things on the planet. I think that everybody on the planet should try it at least once in their life. I think
they've helped me immensely.
Yes.
And they've helped me emotionally.
Yes.
They've helped me become a better person.
Yes, I agree.
They have not made me see Mickey Mouse ever.
I have been on only two crazy journeys out of like 2,000 plus trips. So I've tripped thousands of times on mushrooms. Thousands of times. And only one time ever have I really had an experience that, like, truly stuck with me. And it was on only 3.5 grams.
Mm-hmm.
And it was off of a species. A species known, I want to say, in the non-academic culture. Because there's no, like, proper taxonomy for it. No proper name for it. But it is known in the non-academic community as Doc Hawk Beach. It is found...
Doc Hawk Beach?
Yeah, D-A-K-A-K Beach. It is found on a beach in the Philippines.
Okay.
And it is possibly one of the strongest species that I've ever eaten in my life. And off of 3.5 grams, and I've eaten upwards of like 20 grams before, I have had the strongest trip I've ever had in my life. And I specifically remember it from almost start to finish. Hitting the peak, I was with my group of friends, and they had all left to go on, like, a night walk, and I had ended up waiting for them to come back, but I was sitting on my buddy's couch, and I, like, the moment I closed my eyes and they walked out the door, I was cascaded into, like, the universe, and I was riding a beam of light going through, again, the universe, going through space, seeing all of the different stars around me, going through different solar systems, like, at the speed of light.
But your sense of self, did you have a very clear sense of self?
I didn't know. You didn't. Like, I literally was in the moment. Like, yeah. Like, the moment I closed my eyes, I thought I might have been dreaming. You know, I might have passed out, I might have gone into a dream, but it was so intense. And, like, when they came back inside, you know, I snapped out of it immediately.
To remember when you kind of snapped out of it? Was it kind of blurry?
No, so
it was very clear.
Yeah, so I told them, like, I even shared the experience with them, because, again, by this point, you know, we had tripped hundreds of times together.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that anything had ever happened, so I was explaining them the same thing that I was explaining to you. Riding this beam of light through space, seeing all the different planets, like, I could stop in slow-mo and, like, see a planet and, like, dive into the atmosphere and see, like, all of the, I don't know what you would call it, like, if I were to pass Jupiter, I could see, like, the gas and all of the makeup and everything around the planet, and it was one of the most insane experiences ever, and it ended the moment that they reopened the door and came back inside, and I, like, snapped out of it and, like, came back into, you know, base consciousness, and, you know, it was one of the most insane things, and I think that
sounds gorgeous, though.
It was beautiful, and it made me think that there is a lot more to life than what we understand, that there is so much more beyond the physical form of what we understand life, getting into the medical physical or metaphysical form.
So I'll fragment myself often. So my inner voice is like, it's words. I think in words, you know, I even dream in words. So, like, often I'll wake up in the middle of the night out of dreams, and I'll wake up and I'll be sitting in my bed, and it's like I'm in the middle of a conversation between two people, and it's like really fucking loud, and it's always like a lecture I half understand. And, like, 90% of the time, it's probably something I was reading, because I don't think it's anything outside of me. I think it's me. I think it's just segments of myself just going over shit. You know? Like, so, like, the cap, especially when I hit a good gallop, when I'm in a good pace, when I'm sitting in my bed listening to my music, you know? Like, I can seriously, that's one of the things, is like, I can literally pick apart a lot of the words. And dimethyltryptamine has been an easier force just because of its edge, you know, and I have a lot of experience with that one. And so one of the things that I've heard, because I don't have any really great stories, I have a lot of interesting analogies I built out of my demise. I've had a lot of stressful stuff that I've built analogies out of that I've made helpful.
Okay.
But I just don't see anything interesting I find it incredibly helpful still. You know, okay. I there's a reason that I keep coming back. If it wasn't incredibly helpful, I wouldn't. You know, you know. Yeah. So I want to caveat that. But I had a really good friend. I was probably really fresh out of high school, 18, 19 years old, when I had first encountered dimethyl. And I witnessed this friend take a pretty hefty dose. You know, like 4 times as much as I would see most people go for. Like he hit the piece probably like 4 or 5 times. And one of the ways that I put pillows behind people and set them up on a bed, and then like I'd let them, you know, use it, and then I'd walk out of the room, usually would let them have music on, and I would just leave them alone for about 5 or 6 minutes and not even fuck with them. And then I'd go back into the room, usually with a cup of water, be like, hey, you want some water? 99% of the time the dude's like, yeah, I want some fucking water, please. You know, so like I give him the water, and I walk out again. I usually come back in. 10 minutes later, that person's completely down to earth, you know, ready to tell me about shit's going on, right? Yeah. So that's usually what happens on a good day. So this guy takes a pretty hefty dose, and I go out, and I sit out, and I'm sitting smoking a cigarette on my back porch, and I look through the glass, and I see him. He's up, and I'm like, okay. He shouldn't be able to walk right now. Not very well. And so he's up and he's sitting in the door of my bathroom, and then I just see him fall, and I'm like, oh shit. And so I'm like, it's like, I'm gonna give him a second, give him a couple minutes, because with dimethyl it's so quick. 5-10 minutes you wait it out, and like it doesn't matter, like it's such a quick thing, you know,
right?
Like, and so I'm like, I'm just gonna wait. And so I see him get up 3 minutes later. He comes up to the glass, he's white as a ghost, and I'm like, you okay? And he's like, yeah, I'm gonna go home. And I'm like, all right. And so he comes back to my house the next day, and he's a beautiful artist. I have a lot of his art actually hanging around the house. I'll show it to you on the way out. Most of the art around here is mine. So he comes up, and he has 3 pieces of art, and he shows me this first picture, and it's this giant creature, and he's standing in its hand. And he's like, when I got to your bathroom, there was a hole in your floor, and I fell into that hole, and I woke up in another world. And he's like, and I fell in a hole in that world, and I woke up in another world. And he's like, I was like going through worlds for it felt like a while. And he's like, but I wasn't afraid. You know, I felt like I was doing what I was supposed to do, so I felt it felt purposeful, so I just kept going. And he's like, at the end of my journeys, he's like, I woke up in the hand of this giant beast that looked down at me and said, hi, little creature. I'm the one who builds the tunnels between your world and ours. And he's like, and then I woke up. And I was like, okay. You know, like, and so, and then he's like, the second piece of paper was like the star sheet. It was like just all these little pieces of stars, you know. And he's like, it looked like a starscape. And he's like, I drew this. And the next one was a bunch of like interconnected circles making a bunch of Venn diagrams, you know, like just a bunch of circles that looked random. And he's like, and you put them on top of each other, and all of the intersecting lines of the circles matched up perfectly with a dot. And he's like, I drew these about 6 hours apart, you know. And he's like, I just felt like I should draw it. I felt compelled to. And he's like, I think I drew a map, you know, like. And so that's one of the most interesting stories I've been told, you know.
That is awesome.
Like,
I love hearing stories like that. Like, honestly,
like, and then another one of my friends, every time he'd hit the dimethyl, he behind his eyelids he'd see a staircase, and then a little dude would come down and grab his hand and walk him up to a staircase, and he'd go through a door. You know, like, it's weird, you know. Like, and I think it comes down to different factors of creativity.
Yeah, you know, it definitely
does. I think I'm just a very dense person.
First time I did DMT, I don't even know if I did it right, but I know that it definitely cascaded me into into a like collage of just colorful beings. Like, they were all different colors, just blue, green, yellow. And it was like, how do I explain this? The movie Soul, the Jerry's, it was like the outlines, but they were all different colors, and then they were all just kind of dancing around me.
She shows crazy. You the most beautiful things,
dude. It was
the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. And something that you should try personally,
yeah,
is to try, if you ever have access, on the top of your mushies, try to take that little leap. It's a little extra leap. And the first time I ever did it, I was so scared.
Yeah.
I didn't know if I was going too far and being too overzealous, but I was rewarded. It's the most beautiful things is when you mix those two.
I honestly like pushing the envelope. I'm constantly trying to expand my consciousness, trying to expand my understanding.
I don't think it's going to hurt you. Yeah. I don't think even if you go personal, this is not advice. This is not advice. This is not advice. Personally, I think with these trips means, like, even if you go a little bit too far, you're still going to learn a good lesson. You know, like, I've hurt myself severely with deems where you can hit that piece one extra time too many, and all of a sudden you're Wile E. Coyote, and you're just... And you're just pacing around like, oh, shit. I've had some moments where I was seriously concerned that I might be batshit crazy.
I think that... Like, any psychedelics really really can do that, though, because I think it forces those things out. Like, I think it forces out the things that we need to work on as individuals. 'Cause subconsciously, we know what, you know, we should quote. And, because I don't want to put reason behind anything, but we know what we should be doing, right? Like, we know what we should be doing as an individual on a daily basis to...
It's called personal moral ethics.
Yes, to be the best person that we can be, and we often fall short of that, and we often take the wrong route when we know we should have taken the right route, but it doesn't make us, again, quote, bad people. It doesn't make us, quote, wrong people. It doesn't put any type of negative connotation behind it, but at the same time, you know that there's something that you could be doing better, and better is a very subjective word as well.
But it's based upon that own little inner you, because I call it personal moral ethics,
yes.
And it's something we build. But I do think that there's something inherent. I think that there's an inherent drive to want that betterness,
yes,
like you said. And I think a lot of people don't. I hate to put words in other people's mouth, but I feel that a lot of people aren't aware that they have control to build their moral ethical code. And a lot of people are just going through their lives reacting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt very strongly about my moral ethical code. And maybe it's because I've been interacting with things like the cap since I was very young.
Yeah.
You know, I always like to think that things like this helped raise me. And the one thing that the cap and stem will always show you is where that disconnect is, between what you wanted to do and what you actually did. And
yes,
there's a disconnect, that dissonance, like that you mentioned earlier. And when I'm working through my intentions throughout the week before a journey, when I'm watching everything I do, and I'm not a saint. Nobody's a saint.
Right.
No. Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
And you're going to do something. You're going to end up heckling your kid. You're going to end up yamming somebody at work when they don't deserve it.
Yeah.
And I'll look at those moments, and I'll be like, oop, this is going to come up.
Yeah.
And guess what? It does.
It does.
And I'm like, okay, yep, I noticed this. Yeah. And I still don't feel good about it. And hopefully next time I'll do better.
Right.
Like,
yeah, no, that's exactly what that is, right? You, like, and that's all you can do is try to be the best person that you can be in every moment of every day. And I think that is a, you know, great life motto to live by. And again, the mushrooms are going to push you to be that person. Like, equilibrium. The mushrooms want there to be, you know, you to work out with everything. They want you to be connected,
including, like, yourself.
Yes.
And how much colony do we got up here? All the different parts of ourselves that we aren't in key with. You know, we got to work a lot. We got to get along with ourselves too.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's a work in progress, is being compassionate to ourselves. You know, we can. Well, there is service to mankind, but in order to be able to serve others, we have to be able to be well, healthy. You know, we can't go help others if we're not healthy.
Right.
You know, and there's that equilibrium again.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep, I agree.
I like that.
Definitely agree.
I think that's a good spot to call it.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you. Yeah, no problem.
Thank you, dude.
Of course.
Like, I'm so grateful for this conversation.
Yes, I genuinely enjoyed it, honestly. I mean, I've been just super busy with business and life lately, so I would love to do it again. I will come better prepared. I will definitely read this book.
100%.
And, you know.
And hopefully next time we talk, will there be some more developments.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Thank you, everybody. If you made it to the end of the show, I really appreciate you, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.